Hello and welcome to Out in the Bay, gay radio from San Francisco. I'm Eric Jansen. This week, we're going to look back at a killing, actually a double killing, a third of a century ago that changed San Francisco forever and also changed the course of the gay rights movement, or at least hastened it. I'm talking about the 1978 killing, assassination, most say, of San Francisco Supervisor Harvey Milk, the first gay elected official of any sizable U.S. city, and Mayor George Moscone. The killer, Dan White, an ex-cop who had also been a supervisor, elected the same day as Harvey Milk, as a matter of fact, until he resigned his office shortly before the killings. Ostensibly, it's because Mayor Moscone wouldn't give White his seat back that prompted White to shoot the mayor, and then Milk, because he also, White felt, had broken his word to White. But there's so much more to it. My guest this evening knows probably more than anyone else why Dan White did it, except maybe White himself, and he committed suicide a couple of years after serving just 5 years for the double killing, which the jury ruled voluntary manslaughter rather than murder. It's the trial from which the term Twinkie defense came, by the way. My guest also knows a heck of a lot about San Francisco politics. He was a newspaper reporter in San Francisco for many years, and then he covered Dan White's double murder trial and the ensuing White Night riots, the huge riot that erupted after White beat the murder rap, for Rolling Stone, Time, and the LA Times. The trial left reporter Mike Weiss wanting to know more. So he researched and interviewed extensively and wrote Double Play, The Hidden Passions Behind the Double Assassination of George Moscone and Harvey Milk. It's a gripping account of why Dan White did it and a fascinating look at the modern history of San Francisco and gay politics. Double Play won an Edgar Award for Best True Crime Book of the Year. Mike Weiss will delve into the details for us during this hour, and you'll even hear from Dan White himself as we play part of his chilling taped confession. And we'll also hear a little bit of Weiss's taped interview with Dianne Feinstein describing some of what she saw on that grisly Monday in late November 1978. Mike Weiss, welcome to Out in the Bay.
Thank you, Eric. It's a pleasure to be here.
So let me just start by asking why this event of a third century ago, 33 years ago, why does it matter now?
Oh, well, it matters because it was an insurrection in the sense that it was the only time that I know of in American history where one sitting elected city official killed two other city officials. It was an insurrection in the sense that it was an attempt to change the way in which the city was progressing and send it back to an earlier era. It was an insurrection because Dan White, who until that moment had been a law-abiding citizen, a cop, a fireman, an army vet, and so on, family man, found himself instead to be a murderer. And it matters also because of the consequences that have flown from it. One of those consequences, just to touch on a few of them lightly, I'm sure we'll get into some of this more heavily later, is that Dianne Feinstein's political career had dead-ended. These events changed that and, of course, made her the most powerful politician ultimately in the state of California. And it also matters, it seems to me, if you want to talk about the law of unintended consequences, because I think Harvey's death made him into a martyr. And movements need martyrs. And Harvey became a became more than just another politician who was a groundbreaker, but an actual galvanizing force, I think, for the gay movement, and the subject of numerous Academy Award-winning films, operas, books, so that in his death, Harvey became something I don't think he could have become had he lived. Although, let me just hasten to add that he accomplished a lot while he lived, too.
He did. He did, certainly did. There's so many questions to ask. It's hard to know where to start exactly. First of all, let's talk a little bit about the murder rap. He wasn't convicted of murder. He was convicted of manslaughter.
Yes, he was charged with first-degree murder for both killings. And was in fact convicted of voluntary manslaughter and served a total of something like 5.5 years or 5 years and 8 months in prison, and then was released. And that verdict, people say it outraged a great number of people, but it also frightened people. If Dan White could assassinate Harvey Milk and receive a manslaughter sentence, how was any gay man to feel immune from the consequences of violence himself.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think what motivated the riot, and it's the most unique riot I've ever seen or been in on the night of the verdict, was a combination of anger and fear. And it was an extraordinary event. I mean, you had masses of San Franciscans, most of whom looked to be middle class, literally attacking City Hall, physically attacking City Hall, smashing the doors and trying to break through and setting afire police cars. I've never seen anything quite like it. I saw a lot of anti-war riots and civil rights riots in my day, and this was different.
For those who weren't there weren't living here at the time, describe that a little bit. What was the White Night riots? I mean, we heard of the cop cars being burned.
The verdict came out, and word spread through the city like a virus. I mean, it was faster than the internet before anyone had ever thought of the internet, and before you knew it, thousands of people were marching down Market Street towards City Hall, and they gathered in the plaza, shouting and chanting their dismay. The cops marshaled just inside the Polk Street doors of City Hall, and then, as I say, ultimately what happened, the police were being held back, much to their frustration, by their chief, Charles Gayne. In City Hall, the mayor and others, Mayor Feinstein, other officials were cowering, and I don't blame them for cowering one bit. And then the cops were set loose as the glass was being smashed in City Hall, and what broke out was a fight.
Mm-hmm.
It was an extraordinary fight. I saw some things I couldn't believe. Just a few feet from me, there was this massive woman who looked like a dyke on bike, wearing black leathers, and she was grunting, and I turned around, and facing her was a woman built very much like her, wearing a police uniform, and the two of them were throwing haymakers at each other.
Uh-huh.
And I thought, God, I've never seen anything like this in my life. And then when the police cars began to burn...
How many of them were set on fire?
Nine in total.
Okay.
Imagine the Civic Center Plaza lit by nothing except burning police cars, and thousands of people screaming and shouting and surging against City Hall, and policemen and individual protesters fighting. And then as the cars burned, their sirens began to bleat.
Mm-hmm.
So you had this, you know, horrible bleating noise as the soundtrack to this scene lit by fire. And it was utterly devastating and as I say, quite the most extraordinary thing I ever saw. A friend of mine made a bad mistake. He got caught in a sudden police movement toward him and held up his press card. Bad judgment of error. He got the crap beat out of him, ended up in the hospital with several broken ribs and long term health consequences. So it was a very indiscriminate violence on the part of both the people who had massed at City Hall and on the part of the police.
And after that, there was some retaliation in the Castro neighborhood by the police.
Oh, that's right. The police went up to the Castro and they surged into a number of bars and they beat people up and smashed up
the
bars.
Sort of yanked people out indiscriminately.
Yes, absolutely.
They were protesting.
These were not people who were
right.
protesting. These were people who were sitting in a bar in their own neighborhood having a drink. So, yeah, there were all sorts of consequences and a great deal. Enormous amount of bitterness in the city at that point between the police and the gay community, because the gay community felt that their leader had been assassinated and that his assassin had gotten away with murder, and the police, many of the cops, not all but many, viewed Dan White as one of their own. He had been a San Francisco policeman. He came from an old San Francisco family, and he spoke on the board for the POA and the firefighters union, and they felt that he was being, you know, to this day when I talk about to friends and acquaintances of Dan White, and I still do, they all say the same thing. They all say, well, you know, people lied to him at City Hall, and nobody played straight with him, and they jerked him around, and there's some truth in all of that. But how you get from being a man who wants to hold public office and then discovers that it's a rough game to being somehow forgiven for assassinating the mayor and a supervisor, I don't get. There's a gap I can't leap.
Let's play a little bit of Dan White's confession. This is only not even 2 hours after the killings take place. Is that right?
Yes, it's less than 2 hours. He assassinated the two men. He ended up...
This is a Monday morning, right? Over the weekend, he was told, somehow he got the impression that George Moscone was supposed to call him.
He had resigned his seat. It's such a detailed story, but let me give you a very brief version. He resigned his seat and then, under pressure from his supporters, asked for it back. And at first, George Moscone said he would give it back to him, and then he changed his mind for purely political reasons. The board was divided between 6 anti-Moscone votes and 5 pro-Moscone votes. When Dan White resigned, all George's allies came to him and said, you've got to change the balance of power here. We can really do things. Foremost among them, Harvey Milk, and who said to George, if you reappoint Dan White, you're dead in the gay community. And George had counted on gay votes. And so then after the assassinations, when Dan found out that he had been betrayed by George and he had killed George and he felt very betrayed by Harvey at a much more personal level, he killed Harvey, ran to the cathedral, his wife joined him, and they walked down to the old Northern Station on Ellis Street between Polk and Van Ness. He turned himself in. He was hustled over to the Hall of Justice, and Detective Frank Falzon, who was a very old friend of Dan White's, showed up to interrogate him.
And this is from that interrogation.
Mm-hmm. He sat down, he was talking, and nothing was getting through to me. It was just like a roaring in my ears. And then it came to me, you know.
You couldn't hear what he was saying?
Just small talk that... You know, it just wasn't registered, and what I was going to do now, and, you know, and how this would affect my family, and, you know, and just all the time knowing he's going to go out and lie to the press and tell them, you know, that I wasn't a good supervisor and that people didn't want me, and then that was it. Then I just shot him. That was it.
What happened after you left there, Dan?
Well, I left his office by one of the back doors, and I was going to go down the stairs, and then I saw Harvey Milk's aide across the hall at the supervisor, and then it struck me about what Harvey had tried to do, and I said, well, I'll go talk to him. I said, you know, at least maybe he'll be honest with me, you know, because he didn't know I had heard his conversation. And he was all smiles and stuff, and I went in. And like I say, I was still upset, and I wanted to talk to him and just try to explain to him, you know. I didn't agree with him on a lot of things, but I was always honest, you know. And here they were devious, and then he started kind of smirking because he knew I wasn't going to be reappointed, and he just didn't make any impression on him. I started to say, you know, how hard I worked for it, and what it meant to me and my family and my reputation as a hard worker, good, honest person, and he just kind of smirked at me as if to say, too bad. And then I just got all flushed and hot, and I shot him.
That's Dan White confessing to the killing of Supervisor Harvey Milk, and before that, Mayor George Moscone in 1978, just 2 hours after the killings. And my guest, you're listening to Out in the Bay on KALW. My guest is Mike Weiss, the author of Double Play, The Hidden Passions Behind the Double Assassination of George Moscone and Harvey Milk. The audio on that CD, the audio that we just heard, is included in a DVD that's included with the book.
Yes, the entire confession is on DVD, and it comes with the book.
And if time allows, we may hear a little bit more of that confession later. Mm-hmm. As we were listening to this, Mike, I saw you scribbling some notes, and well, in the DVD, there's some commentary that goes along with it,
yes.
Sort of pointing out, you know, he's a an ex-cop himself, so he
yes.
maybe knows what not to say, even though he's clearly emotional.
Well, as Frank Falzon, the man, the detective who was interrogating him, said to me later, he said, I've heard hundreds and hundreds of confessions, and I've never heard one that wasn't self-serving. And Dan White was self-serving in his in the confession, and in that little snippet, he tells one outright lie. He says that after having shot the mayor, he decided to go across City Hall, that long distance that we've all walked from Polk Street to the Van Ness Street side, only and give Harvey have talk with Harvey only because he saw Harvey's aide standing outside the door of the supervisor's chambers. That's not true. On the way to City Hall, Dan White told his aide, who was driving him, that he intended to go down and see George and Harvey and give them both a piece of his mind. And he said that on several occasions, according to his own aide, on the way to City Hall.
And that's based on your interviews with her after the fact.
Yes. Yeah. And then, and also testimony at the trial. And then Dan White reloaded his revolver just before he asked Harvey to join him in his empty office. It's not Harvey posed no physical threat to him, so I can't think of any reason why he would, as he said, just shot him, just occurred to him at that moment, and feel the need at the same time to reload his revolver before he talked to Harvey, according to him.
Maybe he didn't always carry a loaded revolver around?
No, he didn't always carry a loaded revolver around. In fact, he went to some lengths to avoid the metal detector in City Hall on that day, climbing through a basement window so that his gun wouldn't be detected as he entered City Hall, and did a whole bunch of other things, which clearly indicated that he had a plan and a design. But, you know, I'd like to say a little something, if I may, I'd like to read a little passage from the book about the state of the city at the time leading up to the elections of Dan White and Harvey Milk, and then to talk a little bit about their relationship, if I may, because
Please.
It's a very complex relationship. This is a passage from fairly early in the book, and it attempts to describe the situation vis-a-vis the Castro district and the rest of the city in the late 70s. It didn't matter to anti-gay bigots that Harvey himself cared about kids, that as a supervisor he would fight and beat the Board of Education when it threatened to close down his local elementary school. They never knew that Harvey was the kind of man who would give an hour-long interview to a junior high school kid while an aide impatiently tried to pry him loose to attend to other business. What mattered to them was that Harvey was a spokesman for homosexuality, that he wouldn't apologize for it or urge gay men to cool it. Harvey's own style was frumpy. There was something of Buster Keaton in his long face and sad eyes and plastic comic expression. But Harvey was not typical. Nor was it typical for two homosexuals dressed in matching outfits of black leather vests, no shirts, tight leather chaps, and black cowboy hats to sashay down the street, one shrieking at the other, "Oh, you silly girl, you!" But it happened. And that was what some straight people remembered and talked about, even those who didn't have any moral qualms about homosexuality. Such scenes were in and of themselves amusing, but experienced again and again in one form or another, they could be disquieting. That some reasonable liberal people who had always supported civil rights and women's rights found themselves discomfited by gay assertiveness. It seemed that street gays, at least, combined effeminacy with posturing machismo to concoct a subculture out of the least appealing aspects of both femininity and masculinity. And the mockery of some gay attitudes towards simple traditional values in the culture avoid many other San Franciscans because they suggested class distinctions. Their archness was understood as a form of condescension, and little thought was given to the idea that it might be a defense against bias and against prejudice. And even the word gay itself, what's so gay, people ask themselves, about guys who socialized in bars with names like the boot camp and the trench. When you combined it all, the moral objections rooted in Catherine doctrine, the class objections, the economic objections based on the relative freedom of gays to be unconcerned about the future because they would not have children. Obviously, this was written a long time a long time ago.
Yeah.
What you had was a kind of sexual integration crisis, made worse by the stampede of politicians falling all over each other in their haste to befriend a large and growing number of voters. That was what Harvey Milk confronted when he decided that sooner or later he would win elected office in San Francisco, a gay man running as a champion of his own kind, but wanting to represent everybody from school kids to old ladies on fixed pensions whose rents were threatened by the landlord's markets and created at least in part by the number of gays willing to pay top dollar. A lesser man would have blanched and retreated into the quietude that characterized gay leaders with whom City Hall usually did business. But Harvey never lost his heart or his sense of humor. Milk has something for everybody. That was his first campaign slogan.
That's Mike Weiss reading from his book, Double Play, The Hidden Passions Behind the Double Assassination of George Moscone and Harvey Milk. You're hearing a special hour-long edition of Out in the Bay today. It is the fall fund drive, fall membership drive for KALW. I'll just take a quick moment to let you know that you can have this book as a premium, as a thank you gift during this hour. Actually, you can have it any time, but we'd love it if you called during this hour, because I would certainly love the support of you becoming a member during my show, Out in the Bay. We're proud of KALW for, you know, for taking a chance on a gay program 7 years ago when you'd think in the San Francisco Bay Area there would be more. Anyway, Vince Emery, the publisher, has graciously donated 10 copies of Double Play for us to use during the membership drive. They're available for new members who donate $100 or more. Or if you're already a KALW member, make an additional donation to bring your level of support up to $100. And the book and companion DVD is yours. KALW.org is the website. Or you can call in 800-525-9917. That's 800-KALW-917. We just have 10 of those books available, the first 10 to contribute $100 or more. You can join us at any level, of course. We appreciate your support. Also, if you have a question that you would like to ask of Mike Weiss, the author here, he knows all kinds of things about San Francisco politics during the 70s and since, and about the Dan White murder trial and all the goings on. This book is fascinating. When you call, go ahead and ask my friend Brian, who's here, or Annette, and they will be happy to pass along a note or a question. They can bring it into the studio to me, and I'll ask it on the air. Or you can send an email to Eric with a C @outinthebay.com. Again, the number is 800-525-9917, or go online to KALW.org. Thanks. Now, I want to ask you, Mike, the changes, it seems, there were, besides, you know, this new gay political power, there were a lot of other changes going on in San Francisco at the time.
Yes.
You talk in the book about knowledge workers coming
yes.
in and this displacement
yes.
of sort of traditional families. They had to move out to the edges of town and then to the suburbs.
Yes.
And that was also part of what Dan White and his whole crowd were kind of rebelling against.
Very much so. They felt as though their city was being invaded by outlanders. And these outlanders did not work with their hands and their backs the way Dan White's people always had. They worked with their brains. They were the president or chairman of the board of a Bank of America, called them knowledge workers. And there was a very graphic symbolic representation of their ascendancy within the city. Until the mid-70s, the highest point in the city was the cross on Mount Davidson. And then Sutro Communication Tower was built on top of Twin Peaks, and this communication tower exceeded the cross. And
mm-hmm.
I always thought of that as extraordinarily symbolic. To this day, Sutro Communications Tower interests me in part because we don't even really see it. But if you start paying attention, just the next time you're out and about in the city, start paying attention, you'll see that you can see it from almost every point in the city. It is the defining feature of our landscape, and yet we hardly notice it. But yes, and that dislocation was created economic hardship, and it created deep resentments. And the gay movement was only a part of that. I mean, there were a lot of younger people moving in, mainly from the East Coast and from Los Angeles, and they were becoming a growing political force, and they were an important element in the election of George Moscone, as well as in the election of Harvey Milk. Harvey Milk and Dan White were sent to City Hall by their small districts for very similar reasons. They were both sent by constituencies who felt neglected and ignored by City Hall. They were both relatively fresh faces. They were not part of the establishment. And they both promised to be not career politicians, but honest, good men. There was, when they arrived at City Hall, a certain affinity between Dan White and Harvey Milk. Dan, in particular, reached out to Harvey. He seemed somewhat fascinated by Harvey. And he saw both of them as being scrappy outsiders. And he tried to negotiate a number of things with Harvey. And, for instance, Dan White opposed a center for troubled youth that was going to be built in his district by the Sisters of the Good Shepherd. He opposed it more than he opposed, cared about anything else on the board. And Harvey had promised to give him his vote on that because it really didn't matter that much to Harvey.
Right. And he was going to vote against it. He was going to do a little help.
Yes. And then he changed his mind and voted for it without informing Dan first. And Dan was livid. He was furious at Harvey.
And this is right after Dan White had actually voted for a gay rights ordinance for the city that Harvey Milk had proposed, right?
Well,
at least in committee.
No, then it came up.
No, but I thought in the book that in committee, he supported it.
Yes, he had supported it.
And then, like, the very next day.
And then the following week, the gay rights ordinance came to a vote, and Dan White, who had told Harvey he would vote for it, vote against it, and he told Harvey's aide, Dick Pabich, from here on in, it's personal between me and Harvey.
Mm-hmm.
He's lied to me. He's betrayed me. But earlier that year, Harvey was the only supervisor that Dan White invited to the christening of his first son, Charlie. And at that christening, he introduced him to his uncle, Tom, and he said to him, "Tom, I want you to meet one of the greatest guys I know," and introduced him to Harvey. And they were being watched by Ray Sloan, who was Dan's campaign manager and chief aide at City Hall. And Sloan, looking at the two of them, had this sudden thought that Dan loved Harvey, and he also bore him a tremendous grudge.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there was something extremely personal about them. One of the things that is in the new edition of the book that was not in the first edition is the fact that Ray Sloan, Dan White's aide, was gay.
Okay.
And I didn't know that myself. I had talked to Ray for many, many hours. It had never come up. We were just talking back when I researched the book originally.
Mm-hmm.
And then in this more recent interview, Ray told me that he was gay. And I said, "Well, did Dan know that you were gay?" And he said, "Well, he must have." I said, "Well, were you out of the closet?" He said, "I never was in the closet. I just lived my life," he said. And so there's no way Dan wouldn't have known, but we never once discussed it. So that's complex.
I was struck by that. When you and I spoke on the phone about a week ago, I asked you about the speculation. There had been a lot of speculation about whether or not Dan White was actually gay, and it was repressed about it.
Yes.
And then there were a couple passages in this book that sort of allude to it, this being one of them, where it says Ray Sloan, and I hadn't read the whole book yet, so I didn't realize that Ray Sloan is gay. And this is, again, Ray Sloan is Dan White's supervisorial aide. So he works in his office every day.
He was also his campaign manager.
Right.
They were very close.
Right. So he looks at these two at this party, and he liked his free drinks, as you said.
Mm-hmm.
I love the way you make all these scenes so colorful. It must have been lots of research. But we can talk about that later. I'm curious about how you get so many details, and it's like you're painting this picture, and how accurate can you be when you weren't actually there?
Well,
and it's just...
It's easily done. What you do is you do all the research you can. And, of course, I was at every day of the trial, and I'm forgetting now if it was 6 or 7 different psychiatrists and psychologists testified, and every one of them had interviewed Dan White in depth. So that provided an enormous amount of detail. And then the way you do it, as any reporter would tell you, is I say to you, "So, Eric, you were there that day." And you say, "Yes." And I say, "Boy, it must have been interesting. What was Harvey wearing? Do you remember? Does anything about it stand out? Were you guys drinking? What did you drink? How were you feeling about that?"
Right.
And so on and so forth, as well as asking what you might call the more substantive questions.
Right,
just ask people who were there to describe what they saw and what they remembered. And you supplement it as much as possible by going to the scenes yourself and looking at things and You know, you just...
So all kinds of little details come out, but I did get a little derailed there, didn't I? So anyway, okay. Ray Sloan is at this party, and he's had his drinks.
This is Dan White's christening.
Yeah, the christening of Dan White's first
son.
Child.
Yes.
And so he's looking around, and he's like, wow, look, there's some... the passage in your book could be read as, oh, there's this attraction. Dan White loves Harvey Milk.
It could be.
And then there's also this section earlier that I wanted to ask you about. I was trying to find it before we went on the air so I could possibly read it. But it's a scene where, as new supervisors, Carol Ruth Silver also was elected to the board at this time. This is the first time that there's district elections in San Francisco. So these new folks are primarily kind of representing neighborhoods.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So Harvey Milk has got a seat on the far end, and then Carol Ruth Silver, and then Dan White's seat.
Right.
And Carol Ruth Silver and Harvey Milk would sort of kibitz with each other about, they'd look past...
Yes.
At Dan, and then he made some comment about his physique and also good looking.
A lot of sexual innuendo, because both Carol Ruth and Harvey were good friends, and they both had good senses of humor. And Dan was very rigid, and he was out of his element on the Board of Supervisors, and the two of them weren't. And they would look at him, and Carol Ruth would say, you know, Marianne, that's Dan's wife, she's a very substantial, solid sort of woman. I don't know what she sees in this guy. And Harvey would say, well, if you turn him upside down, you'd know what she sees in him. And Dan was a strong man. He had a, you know, physically in great shape. One of the first things that the homicide inspector Frank Falzon noticed when he showed up at the scene of Dan White's suicide, Dan White, on the day he killed himself, was wearing a cut-off shirt so his abs would show. And one of the first things he noticed was that he had no body fat on him whatsoever. Of course, he had just spent years in prison, and so a lot of guys come out of prison pretty cut. But you know, Dan White was an athlete. I mean, he was a hunk. He was a good-looking man. I don't have any reason to believe that Dan White was in the closet. It's certainly possible.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying it's an impossible thing, but no one has ever shown me any real reason to believe it, except... a feeling that maybe he was, but you know.
So let's get to the part of the, you know, mm-hmm. a lot of people perceive this as an anti-gay and hate crime.
Yes.
But with all the changes going on in the city, it seemed more like it was a revolt against that or these personal passions.
Yes.
What's your take on that? And why did he get off?
That's a lot
of questions at once.
Do you want me to answer them all at once?
Any order you want to.
I agree with Ann Cronenberg, let me see if I can find
one of Harvey Milk's Milk's top aides.
She's now the an official at the Department of Public Health here in San Francisco, she was one of Harvey's aides, portrayed in the movie. She's the woman on the motorcycle in the movie, and she said to me. That she doesn't agree with the people who believe Harvey was killed because Dan was homophobic. It's too pat, she said, to say that Harvey was killed because he was gay. I think Dan was a very troubled person. He was frustrated. He was betrayed. And the fact that Harvey was gay was just on top of that.
Mm-hmm.
Dan White was a very, very competitive guy. He went down to City Hall with this naive belief that what happened in politics was everybody stated their ideas and the best idea prevailed. And he was being bested by Harvey, who was gay. I think that probably rankled him.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think it troubled him that it rankled him so much. And I think because he felt this affinity for Harvey and then he felt betrayed by Harvey, I think he killed him because he felt betrayed by him and humiliated mm-hmm. by him. And I don't think... the fact that Harvey was gay really figured in it at all. I mean, he had a list. Another new thing, a new revelation in this book, is that after Dan White was released from prison and came back to San Francisco But before he came back, he lived in L.A. for a year, and Falzon, the cop who was his friend and also the person who took his confession, went down and saw him there at Dan's request. And Dan told him, first of all, that he had gone down to City Hall intending to commit these murders, which was not what he said at the trial. And secondly, he told him not only did he want to kill George and Harvey, but he also hoped to kill Carol, Ruth Silver, and Willie Brown. Mm-hmm. So he had a list of four people, and they were, in his view, the leaders of the political movement that was changing, or he would say probably destroying his city. And that's why Harvey was killed, mm-hmm. in my view. Of course, we'll never know, because Dan White maybe never spoke a truthful word about it and then killed himself. So it would be hard to say. Now, the other question
Noel,
was...
now, hold on just a second.
Okay.
First of all, you just mentioned Willie Brown.
Yes.
And we did have a caller earlier who I've been passed a note, asked about Willie Brown's involvement. I don't know exactly what the caller means about his involvement and what, but where is Willie Brown in the scene at this point?
Willie Brown is a friend of George Moscone's and an ally of the Burton brothers, John and Philip. And they constitute the Burton machine, which was a powerful political machine in Northern California and throughout the state. And and Willie was also a very close friend of George's. And on the day of the assassinations, Willie, who worked in Sacramento, happened to be in San Francisco City Hall. And he was sitting in George Moscone's office, and they were planning a Christmas shopping trip that they took together every year for their wives. And they always went to a lingerie show at one of the big downtown department stores. And they were laughing about that and having a good laugh. When Dan White showed up and George Moscone's secretary said to him, you know, via an intercom, Dan White is here. And George said, I got to talk to him. Willie said, well, I'll go out the back door. And so it was almost like a French bedroom farce. Mm-hmm. Dan White is walking in the front door and Willie Brown is walking out the back door. And Willie Brown did not know that until I told him that a number of years later after Falzon had told me.
He didn't realize how close the timing was, you mean?
He knew how close the timing was, but he didn't have any idea that he was on Dan White's hit list.
Oh, that right, of course.
So okay. I was telling him, in effect, you escaped being killed by... You know,
yeah,
this much.
Yeah, him too. Yeah.
It's a pretty hard thing to hear.
Mm-hmm, I bet.
And that was really a Willie Brown's only involvement. I mean, he wasn't directly involved, that I know, in any of Dan White's political grievances. But he was a symbol of the change, not only because he was a part of that machine, but perhaps because he was a black man, you know, mm-hmm. coalition. It was a coalition of neighborhood groups, gay groups, younger groups, labor unions that elected George Moscone. George Moscone, just like Harvey, was a symbol of the changes in the city. And so...
You're listening to Out in the Bay. My name is Eric Jansen. My guest is Mike Weiss. His book, Double Play, The Hidden Passions Behind the Double Assassination of George Moscone and Harvey Milk, is a special thank you gift during this hour. We're in the KALW's Fall Fund Drive. I'll just take this very short break to ask you to go online to KALW.org or call. My friend Brian and Annette are both standing by in the phone room. They'll take your call toll-free at 800-KALW-917. That's 800-525-9917. And if you have a question for Mike Weiss, you can also pass that along when you give us a call. Again, the number is 800-525-9917, or go online to KALW.org and do it that way if you prefer. I actually would like to just play this very... Debbie Kennedy, engineer, I'm going to thank you right now in advance because we're going to go out of order. I want to play the clip from Harvey Milk. And this is a tape that Harvey Milk made knowing it was labeled to be played only in the event of my assassination.
This is to be played only in the event of my death by assassination. I fully realize that a person who stands for what I stand for, an activist, gay activist, becomes the target or the potential target for somebody who is insecure, terrified, afraid, or very disturbed themselves. And knowing that I could be assassinated at any moment or any time, I feel it's important that some people know my thoughts. I stood for more than just a candidate. I have never considered myself a candidate. I have always considered myself part of a movement, part of a candidacy. I wish I had time to explain everything I did. Almost everything was done the eyes of the gay movement.
So he mentions something in there, Harvey Milk, there about sort of assuming that he might be assassinated by someone disturbed, I think was the word he used.
Mm-hmm.
That certainly was the case.
Well, yes.
At the time he made this tape, he wasn't thinking about Dan White specifically, but...
I'm sure not.
Yeah, yeah.
You don't think about the people you know and do business with on a daily basis as one of those people,
right.
One of those lunatics who's going to come get you. Dan White, you asked me a little earlier, and it ties right into what we're talking about now. How did Dan White get away with this? What was the trial like? The trial was one of the more surreal events of my life. The audience section, where the press sat and relatives and just people who were curious, was separated from the well of the courtroom by thick security glass. And so it had a looking glass effect. I mean, you felt as though everything that was going on inside that glass, which seemed so unrealistic and not to correspond to the actual events that had occurred, was being on the wrong side of the glass, was walled off in a certain sense. Dan White had two really fine lawyers, Doug Schmidt and Stephen Scherr, and their basic line of defense was this, that good people, law-abiding, upstanding people, family people, hard-working people, don't just kill people in cold blood. There has to be a reason why it happened. And from the beginning of the trial, they conceded that Dan White had committed the crime. They never argued with that. But what they kept emphasizing is we need to understand what happened here. We need to understand why. And they brought a progression of psychiatrists and a psychologist to the witness stand. And what those people testified to was that there was an underlying mental disease, never diagnosed, depression. And under pressure, the pressure he was under, in City Hall, and in the heat of passion, he cracked, and that he was incapable of executing a plan, and that his capacity to hold things in his head in a reasonable fashion was diminished to such a degree that he was not legally culpable for murder. Now, what you have to understand is nobody matters in that courtroom except the 12 people in the jury box. They weren't doing this for San Francisco. They were doing this for the jury, and they had won the trial, in effect, in jury selection. The prosecutors, Tom Norman, the actual prosecutor in the courtroom, and his boss, the DA at the time, Joe Freitas, felt that they had a slam-bang case, open-and-shut murder, and they impaneled a jury which was just the kind of jury that Tommy Norman had used 100 times successfully to get convictions against defendants. It was primarily a working class, primarily a white San Francisco jury. There were four different women on that jury who were Catholic women. Dan White was a Catholic, of an age to be his mother. And the defense could not believe their good fortune, because this was Dan White's constituency. These were the very people who looked at Dan White and saw one of their own and said to themselves, well, that makes sense. He's a good man. What really happened? And then the psychiatrist provided them the grounds for believing that what had happened was a diminished capacity, a heat of passion. But the prosecution was also very inept, not just in its jury selection, but, for instance, there are exceptions in the law under which you cannot invoke a diminished capacity defense. And the primary exception to that in the law is revenge. If your crime is a crime of revenge, then you can't say you are operating under a diminished capacity. And what could have been clearer than the revenge in this case that Dan White was seeking against two politicians who he thought had betrayed him?
Which he said in his taped confession,
And the prosecution never mentioned the word revenge once in the entire trial. So I could go on and on and on about the mistakes the prosecution made, but they were legion.
And was there some piece of key evidence or something that there's something I saw? I don't know if it kept read on the cover flap or whatever.
The confession that we just played was the key evidence.
Yeah.
When the prosecutors played that evidence, when they played that full tape in court, they thought they were slamming the door on Dan White. After all, he does confess to the two murders on the tape. And instead, I remember looking at that jury box and I saw three or four different women crying. What they heard was not what Dan White was really saying. What they heard was a broken man. And it's a very disturbing tape the first time you listen to it. And so sure was the defense that that tape of his confession would have helped their case, that had the prosecution not introduced it, the defense would have introduced it. Mm-hmm. So I think that was probably the very key piece of evidence at the trial, the confession itself, and the complete omission of any politics. The prosecutors wanted, for various reasons of their own, to keep politics out of it. And here you had a political crime. Even Dan White's lawyer, when I visited him recently, he's no longer a lawyer now. He raises cattle up in the north, off in Northern California. I said to him, you know, I'm going to call it assassination, which is not a word we used in the subtitle of the first edition. And he laughed and he said, well, it was an assassination. It just happened to be a manslaughter assassination. And, you know, there really is no such thing.
I'm going to play one more part of his confession since you say that's so important.
Yeah.
So this is we heard the first part of the hour, we heard him describing the actual shooting in the moment, mm-hmm. like, you know, Harvey Milk smirked at him and George Moscone just, you know, asked him questions that made him mad. But this is earlier on in the confession. We're going to play that part now.
I wanted to serve the people of San Francisco well. I did that. Then when the pressures got too great, I decided to leave. After I left, my family and friends offered their support and said whatever it would take to allow me to go back into office, and they would be willing to make that effort. So since I felt the responsibility of the people who had elected me, I went to Mayor Moscone and told him that I had my situation had changed because of the support of family and friends. I would like to retain my seat, be appointed to my seat. So with that in mind, I tried to set my personal affairs in order, preparing to take my seat. And then it came out when Supervisor Milk, some others, were working against me to get my seat back on the board. I learned of this. I was in the city attorney's office when Supervisor Milk called, stating that he was of that mind. He didn't speak to me, he spoke to the city attorney. I was in the office and I heard the conversation and that he was going to try to prevent me from taking my seat again. The mayor never called me. He told me he was going to call me before he made any decision. He never did that. It was only on my own initiative when I went down today to speak with him. I was troubled. The pressure of my family again, my son's out to a babysitter, my wife's got to work, long hours, 50 and 60 hours, never see my family.
So there's part of Dan White's emotional confession at police at the Hall of Justice just 2 hours after
yes,
the...
Yes, but it is emotional. But if you notice that the only times he actually begins to sob are not when he's talking about what he did to George Moscone and Harvey Milk, but when he's talking about how his son's at a babysitter and his wife has to work long hours at a business, which, by the way, was an illegal sweetheart deal given to him that's
at
under investigation it was under investigation by the FBI.
Okay.
This was true throughout Dan White's life. He left suicide notes when he killed himself, and even in those, at the very end of his own life, he did not apologize either to George Moscone's family or Harvey Milk's family or to the city of San Francisco, which he claimed that he loved and he actually defiled.
You're hearing Out in the Bay on KALW. You just heard an excerpt which is included in the DVD companion to this book, Mike Weiss's Double Play, The Hidden Passions Behind the Double Assassination of George Moscone and Harvey Milk. It's a special thank you gift during this hour. You can get it online at KALW.org or call 800-525-9917. That's 800-525-9917. There's some other things in this book that kind of paint some pictures of people, prominent people, that when I talk to my friends about reading this book, and they'll say, well, I didn't know that. Like, for example, that George Moscone was apparently quite a, which word should we use, philanderer, womanizer?
Scamp.
He had a special taste for young African-American women, actually.
Well, apparently, yes.
And that got him into some trouble later. And
it got him into some trouble very early in his career. He got caught as a young politician in a hotel room with a prostitute on Fillmore Street, and the cops who busted him later rose to very prominent positions within the city.
As his sort of thank you to them to pay back?
Their careers rose with his. His friend Willie Brown used to joke about George that George's only problem is that when he's had two drinks, he thinks he's invisible. and... You know, he had a large appetite for life. He, unlike all our recent mayors, he drove himself around the city in a little red Alfa Romeo. He stayed up late, closed bars, had a good time. He's also a devoted family man. Mm-hmm. Loved his children, loved his wife, and cared about those things. But yeah,
In younger days, in high school days, he was like a dashing young basketball star, right?
He was a prince of the city before anyone was being called a prince of the city. He was a real prince of the city, and handsome, with a roguish smile and a quip for every occasion. And the police hated him for all those qualities. They would tape him in hotel rooms. I know cops who have tapes of George Moscone liaisons. And the fact, one of the things he did is he appointed an outsider to be police chief. And that man, whose name was Charles Gain, was very hated by the rank and file cops. And they saw, many police officers saw George Moscone as a sign of the decadence eating away at the city from the inside. And they resented it. And that had some effect on the attitude toward Dan White. On the day that he committed the assassinations and turned him in, cops would walk into that room and just sort of look at him. It was as if you were seeing your innermost and most secret and awful thoughts made incarnate. I mean, a lot of cops probably wish George Moscone said in their private conversations, he'd be better off dead, which is a thing cops say about people they don't really like, or at least they used to. And now Dan White had actually acted on it.
I'm going to read this little tiny, this is one of the parts I marked, read this one little paragraph. This is in the, as Dan White is sitting in Northern Station, waiting to be transported, I guess, to the Hall of Justice. Again and again over the years, White had listened to cops talking about how they had saved George Moscone from the consequences of his indiscretions. He had seen the drawing on Station House bulletin boards of Moscone's man, Police Chief Charles Gain, in the crosshairs of a rifle. He had participated in an endless grumbling about gays taking over the city, though not in language as polite as that. The talk in the station houses was the blunt, tough talk of the streets the cops were paid to keep safe and knew they couldn't. He had shared the bitter sentiments aroused by the feeling among old San Franciscans that they were a people colonized in their native land. Now cops dropped in to look at White and nod in his direction, and some even came closer and touched him lightly on the arm or the shoulder. Their loose words had not seemed dangerous, but dangerous ideas sometimes find fatal expression, and so now the cops held Dan White in a certain awe. He had stepped over an invisible line. He had transgressed, and yet his transgression had accomplished something that many of them had said or thought they wanted, almost as if he had acted for the collective will. Anyway, I love that passage. There's so many wonderful passages in this book. Go ahead.
We just have a minute.
Got a few minutes.
I wanted to mention something that that I haven't talked about before.
Please.
Which I didn't include in this new edition. But have you Sean Penn? And have you noticed when you think about Harvey? Sean Penn is what actually comes to mind.
Yeah, that face comes to mind now, yeah.
Yeah. Sean Penn was playing Harvey. The movie was being shot in the Castro, and Dan White's son, Charlie, showed up in town. and talked to some people and got into a fight the night before.
Night before the milk showing opened, you mean?
No, the night he was due to visit the set.
Mm-hmm, okay.
And he had been invited by Sean Penn to visit the set, and the night before, he was gay-baiting some people, and he was very drunk, and one of the people who had spent some time with him and another person on the set, they both told me this themselves, were so upset by the idea that Dan White's son was coming to the set that they called the cops. And there was a large police presence when he got to the set. And in fact, nothing untoward happened. And Sean Penn, from what I was told, behaved, you know, just in a really fine fashion, ended up taking him out to lunch and, you know, calming him down and talking with him. But I know that Dan White's son went to the set in part because he was concerned that his mother would be misportrayed in the movie. And indeed, Marianne White is a victim of this crime. Mm-hmm. Perhaps one of, you know, as much a victim as in her way as the Moscone family and the Milk family. Mm-hmm. Perfectly innocent person who ended up alone having to raise three kids, one of whom has Down syndrome, mm-hmm. through no fault of her own because her husband committed a dastardly deed and then took his own life. Mm-hmm. So anyway, you asked about, you know, why should we still be concerned? Well, in the lives of some people, this crime will never end. And there's quite a lot of people whose lives were touched by Harvey and by George and by Dan White. And for them, this crime never ends.
And how did this become such a personal passion for you?
I hated the trial. I hated what I was listening to. It made me sick to my stomach.
Why? In what way?
Because I was listening to a concoction of lies.
You hear the truth on one side, or the truth as presented
no,
by one
neither,
side, or
neither side was presenting the truth,
okay.
And that's how I came to write it.
Yeah.
The defense, though, was in my view brilliant, to be admired, and also somewhat despicable. All of those things, and I have the greatest admiration for those lawyers. They did their job, but I wasn't a lawyer. I was someone sitting there listening to Dan White get away with murder, and it bothered the hell out of me. And because neither the prosecution nor the defense was concerned with the truth, because that isn't their job, I thought, well, this is a very, very important episode in the history of San Francisco, and someone had better try to get to as much of the truth as a journalist can, which isn't all of the truth either.
Well, thank you very much. And we didn't have enough time to get to the description of Dianne Feinstein, which I love, and what her career would have been like if this assassination
we'll
had not
it
happened.
We'll do it again next year, Eric.
Okay, very good. I want to thank my guest tonight, Mike Weiss, author of Double Play, The Hidden Passions Behind the Double Assassination of George Moscone and Harvey Milk, and also the book's publisher, Vince Emery Productions. Vince has donated 10 copies of Double Play for KALW to offer as thank you gifts for those of you who contribute to KALW at the level of $100 or more at KALW.org or by phoning right now, 800-525-9917. My good friend Brian Favorite there, documentary producer, he's there to answer your phone calls. I hope to have him on sometime next year to talk about his documentary about the Faka Ladies of Tonga, which is like a whole transgender, tribal transgender group in Tonga, of all places,
no
where he served in the Peace Corps. Yeah, that'll be next year.
Sounds great.
Anyway, you can learn more about the book Double Play at Vince Emery Productions' website, which is emerybooks.com. Mike, do you have a website that people should know?
No,
okay.
That's the website for me, too. And Emery is E-M-E-R-Y.
EmeryBooks.com. Mm-hmm. Special thanks I would just thank Brian Favorite. Thank you, Brian. Out in the Bay is independently produced by me and Marilyn Pittman. If you value independent local radio and the variety of independently produced programs like Out in the Bay and City Visions and Your Legal Rights and Africa Mix, Voice Box, other music shows, Your Call, Cross Currents, please help us continue to bring them to you. It's KALW's quiet or less obtrusive membership campaign, and it's been working well so far. It certainly worked well in May. We hope that you appreciate that we're not taking 10 minutes out of a program. And I would greatly appreciate you saying you appreciate Out in the Bay while it's on. So call now, 800-525-9917. That's 800-525-9917. The rebroadcast of your call is coming right up, so use this minute and a half to call, 800-525-9917, or click on KALW.org. Get the great, fascinating book, Double Play. It's just full of information about San Francisco politics and history. Or choose another thank you gift. Or let all of your donation go to programming. It's your choice. Please join us. Thank you. If you'd like to hear past Out in the Bay shows or this program in its entirety, if you missed some of the earlier parts, or sign up for free podcasts or take us with you on Stitcher, it's all free on our show's website, outinthebay.com. And drop us a line. We'd love to hear from you. Marilyn at outinthebay.com and Eric at outinthebay.com. I'm Eric Jansen. Thanks for your listening and for your support.